The last call, the last case on this morning's call is the United States against Askew, number 032574. Mr. Curran.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Patrick Curran. I'm a third-year law student under the supervision of Admiral Mikva, arguing today pursuant to Rule 34H and by permission of this Court, here today representing defendant appellant Ulis Askew. This is a case about the definition of conspiracies and about the instructions that explain conspiracies to juries. And in our briefs, we've raised a number of challenges, including problems with the sufficiency of the evidence and lack of probable cause. But today, in a short amount of time, I'll spend our time talking about the insufficiency of these jury instructions, because it goes to the heart of the case. Now, there are two plain errors this Court is faced with today in these jury instructions, and each requires reversal of the conspiracy conviction. First, the District Court gave the jury an incomplete and misleading definition of conspiratorial agreements. The literal language of these jury instructions required a conviction if the government proved no more than a single spot transaction of PCP. Now, that's blatantly incorrect. Nothing could be clearer from this Court's conspiracy precedents over the past 10 years, from Lechuga onward. A single sale of PCP is not a criminal conspiracy. Senator Townsend, even repeat transactions at arm's length are not even probative.
But wouldn't a buyer-seller instruction be inconsistent with the defense that Mr. Askew presented? He claimed to have no involvement with PCP at all. So how would he be harmed by an error in the conspiracy count under plain error standard when his overall sentence will not change even if we were to vacate the conviction on that count?
A few responses there, Your Honor. First, it's true that Mr. Askew did not argue a buyer-seller theory of defense, similar to the defendant in United States v. G, who also did not present a buyer-seller defense or request a buyer-seller instruction, but whose conviction was reversed on plain error for the lack of an instruction. And that's because the buyer-seller instruction goes to the government's burden of proof. Without that instruction, we can't be sure that this jury with its credibility determination, actually found all the elements of this crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, that's exactly the challenge that was in the case in G. It's exactly the challenge we raised here today. Second, we would note that there is an important sentencing consequence of this conspiracy conviction. The relevant conduct determinations are very different if this is a substantive drug crime or if this is a conspiracy that branches over a long period of time. The sentencing consequences are between the order of 17 and a half years or somewhere around 7 years. So in this case, Your Honor, what you've correctly identified is that we're really talking about whether or not the buyer-seller instruction is a theory of defense at all. Now, over the past 10 years, this Court has clearly noted that agreements to buy or sell drugs are not agreements that create conspiracy liability. The buyer-seller instruction explains what agreement means. It's the only thing a jury has to know this Court's complex law of criminal conspiracy. And without a buyer-seller instruction, this jury had no way to know that an agreement to buy or sell a small amount of PCP wasn't a criminal conspiracy. In fact, these instructions said just the opposite. They said a conspiracy is an agreement to achieve an unlawful purpose, and the sentences later it said an unlawful purpose is the possession or distribution of PCP. So the literal language here requires a conviction if there is only a single transaction that the jury believes. Now, the facts of this case illustrate that even when the government presents evidence of a number of transactions, the jury may believe all of that, only some of that, perhaps very little of that evidence, or none at all. And if the jury believes only a little of the government's evidence, believes that only a handful of transactions are credible beyond a reasonable doubt, then that jury needs a buyer-seller instruction to inform it that it hasn't actually received proof of a conspiracy. But unfortunately, under some of the older precedents of this circuit, it's not clear that Mr. Askew could have received a buyer-seller instruction had he requested it. There's an inconsistency that this Court needs to address in this case. Was the buyer-seller instruction available? Should it have been available? I think the answer is clearly yes, because the instruction goes to the government's burden of proof. The government needs to prove that there was an agreement beyond an agreement.
And what was your client's perspective on the evidence at trial?
My client maintained and still maintains his innocence of any substantive drug transaction.
He says he wasn't a buyer or a seller. He didn't have anything to do with this.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so how is the buyer-seller instruction reasonably raised by the evidence?
Well, the government is offering evidence of buyer-seller transactions as evidence of a conspiracy. The government says these transactions prove there was a conspiracy. So the government is introducing the buyer-seller angle into this case. The government is saying you were a buyer and a seller, but you bought and sold so much that this is actually a conspiracy.
Well, it wasn't the selling it to him at wholesale prices.
Your Honor, the government introduced testimony. Ms. Williams introduced testimony of a number of purchases, some of them at very low prices. But the jury's verdict is simply inconsistent with that testimony. And the government acknowledges that. On page 7 of its brief, the government acknowledges, quote, the fact that the jury's drug quantity finding appears to be inconsistent with the government's theory of ongoing conspiratorial dealing. Now, that's an inconsistency that we challenge in our sufficiency argument, but it's also very important for this challenge, the jury instruction. So the standard for reversing on these jury instructions is uncertainty. If this court is uncertain that this jury, not any jury, but this jury with its credibility determinations, would have reached the same conclusion had it been properly instructed, we must reverse for a new trial. We don't need to affirmatively prove that this jury would have found the opposite. We need only prove that there's some uncertainty about what this jury would have done. That's clearly the case in United States v. Mims, where the court noted it needed to reverse under plain error because it could not be sure whether the jury made all the factual findings. Even though the evidence was sufficient, and even though this court wasn't sure what the exact probability of an opposite conclusion was, and even though it's true that a properly instructed jury might nonetheless have still found a criminal conspiracy, the omission of a buyer-seller instruction in Mims, in G, and in this case, creates an unacceptable degree of uncertainty about what this jury actually determined. And that requires plain error reversal. Now, there's a second plain error in these jury instructions that I'd also like to direct the court's attention to. The complete omission of any mention of December 16th, 2001. That's the date at which Christine Williams becomes a cooperating government agent. And it's a date that this court, and Judge Robin noted, has obvious and inescapable importance. Because after that date, there can be no true meeting of the minds. There can be no agreement to create a conspiracy that forms after that date. The jury wasn't instructed as to the obvious and inescapable importance of that date. And as in Thomas, that is a plain error requiring reversal. That's especially the case here, where the jury certified no fewer than 4 questions to the district court, requesting additional guidance on the role that the events of January 5th through 9th should play in its deliberations. And rather than instruct the jury that events after that date couldn't form agreements that created conspiracy liability, this jury was invited to, and I quote, consider whatever evidence you think appropriate, and then was instructed to reread the jury instructions. Those jury questions under United States v. Douglas are probative of confusing and misleading jury instructions. They're probative of inadequate jury instructions. And those inadequate responses, compound the difficulties in this case. The jury instructions here simply left the jury to wander in the dark as to when a conspiracy occurred and what a conspiracy was. And those inadequacies require reversing.
Of course, it's possible, I suppose, that the jury believed that Christine Williams engaged in multiple transactions with Askew, that she fronted drugs to him, but they couldn't agree on the amount beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, I know we shouldn't be sitting here trying to dissect the verdict, but that would explain, would it not, what you think is an irreconcilable discrepancy.
Well, we would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. The government presented evidence of 64 transactions. Now, if this jury had believed that Ms. Williams testified that it was 4 ounces per, if this jury had actually believed that those transactions occurred but was uncertain about the quantity, perhaps that would explain, but that simply isn't a realistic, we would submit, way to view this verdict. Because even if the jury believed that only 1/10 of an ounce had passed hands in each of those transactions, it would still easily exceed 100 grams. And that's on the order of 1/10.
I assume the jury, the instructions, made the translation from ounces to grams.
Yes, the party stipulated, and it was clear that 1 ounce is 28 grams and 4 ounces is 113 grams. I see my time is running short. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Curry. We'll hear now from Ms. Soros.
May it please the court. The defendant waived his right to appeal the district court's jury instructions when he affirmatively expressed his approval of them to the district court. Specifically, he said when the district court asked if he had reviewed the jury instructions, I've looked at the instruction. He's taken out the ones we have agreed to take out, and the changes are all right with me. This is voluntary affirmative conduct. Even if that right was not waived, it was forfeited when the defendant failed to object to the jury instructions at the time of trial, and so this court reviews for plain error. The district court's omission of a buyer-seller instruction was not plain error because the defendant's sentence was not impacted by the conspiracy conviction. In addition, as this court asked the appellant, the buyer-seller theory was not presented to the jury at trial at all. Rather, the defendant claimed that he never bought drugs from Christine Williams and had indeed only spoken to her about the rap music business. Moreover, there is no basis in the evidence to conclude that a mere buyer-seller relationship between Williams and defendants existed. Williams' testimony, the pen register analysis detailing 18 phone calls over a period of 2 months, ranging between 30 seconds and nearly 6 minutes in length, and defendant's own statement in which he admitted to buying and reselling from Williams once before, attempting to buy from her on another occasion, and having known Napoleon Moore, also part of the conspiracy, since 1988, all clearly support a conspiracy and render a buyer and seller instruction, in addition to the Seventh Circuit's pattern jury instruction on conspiracy given by the district court in this case, unnecessary.
Can you distinguish this case from Thomas 1?
Your Honor, I believe that it's distinguishable from Thomas 1 as well as the other cases cited by the appellant in that there is no basis in the evidence to conclude the existence of a buyer-seller relationship. The evidence was not presented by the government as to a mere buyer-seller relationship. Rather, it went to a relationship between two people on the distribution side of a conspiracy. At least one transaction, evidence was presented as to more, with the understanding that that PCP would be resold later as part of the conspiracy.
And what about Thomas 2 on the related point of the proper use of evidence from outside the time frame of the conspiracy?
Your Honor, while the evidence presented at trial included recorded phone calls from January 4th, 2002 and January 9th, 2002, these were clearly not part of the conspiracy. It was after Ms. Williams had been arrested, and at that point she was cooperating with the government. However, this court has held that evidence after the conspiracy can be presented and probative of the nature of an earlier relationship. And in this case, during those phone calls, the parties used familiar language, they made reference to past attempts to get in touch, and the reference to Napoleon Moore by his nickname, Pokey.
I want to take you somewhere else for just a moment, because I'm wondering if the record's going to tell us why the officers who arrested Mr. Askew thought there was a warrant for his arrest, and a very particularized warrant from Magistrate Judge Bobrick.
Your Honor, the record indicates that the arrest of defendant was one of a series of arrests made in this particular PCP distribution conspiracy. A series of arrest warrants had been made, and in this case, when the arresting agent was filling out his arrest report, he drafted a report which indicated that the arrest had been made pursuant to a warrant. There is no indication that the agent believed that he was in possession of a warrant at the time the arrest was made, and indeed, when that draft was submitted to his supervisor and revised, the reference to a warrant was stricken. The defendant did raise this issue in the context of its motion to suppress before the district court, and that motion to suppress was denied.
And I want to take you into a third area for a moment, because I want to ask if you're arguing that whenever the suspected crime is drug-related, police officers may surround a person with guns drawn while they effect a Terry stop. Because that would be, I believe, quite an extension of our cases. In the real world, most people think when they're surrounded by police with guns drawn that they're not free to go anywhere, and that they're under arrest. So we would need a really good reason before we would go about expanding the law here, but your argument seems to me
If I may
sure.
respond, the government is not arguing that a Terry stop is only a Terry stop every time they draw their weapons in the context of a drug-related stop. What we are arguing is that in this case, the fact that the agents had drawn their weapons does not turn the stop into an arrest necessarily, but rather is a Terry stop based on reasonable suspicion in which the officers drew their weapons for their own safety. This case involved drug traffickers and, as I mentioned earlier, an extensive PCP conspiracy. The agents did know from their experience that many drug traffickers are armed and dangerous. And there were multiple people in the car when they stopped it who were not in full view of the officers.
Well, they knew he was arriving shortly in a car and that he was looking for someone else. That's a pretty bare-bones description, isn't it, when you drive into a crowded parking lot?
Your Honor, the agents knew that he was arriving momentarily in a car. They were getting regular radio updates from the agents who were with Christine Williams and listening to her conversations with the defendant. At that point, the agents testified at trial that they saw a car circling the lot, not going up and down the lanes as if it were looking for a spot, but circling the lot as if it were looking for someone. It is for that reason, in addition to the lengthy investigation leading up to that point, that we maintain that they had probable cause to stop the car. In the alternative, it is certainly reasonable suspicion that justifies a Terry stop.
Well, I'm really happy to know that the government's position is not that guns may always be drawn in a Terry stop involving drugs.
No, Your Honor, we're not making that categorical argument, but rather limiting it to this case. As for the conspiracy's end on December 16, 2001, that was expressly stated in the indictment. The court referred to the indictment in its jury instructions, and the jurors took that indictment with them to aid in their deliberations. The court further clarified to the jury that it should not consider any drug quantity after December 16, 2001, in determining a verdict on conspiracy. The evidence is sufficient to support a conspiracy conviction, as I stated earlier, in the context of the jury instructions, given Williams' testimony, the pen register analysis, and the defendant's statement. All of this supports a long-standing agreement whereby Napoleon Moore supplied PCP to the defendant through Christine Williams for distribution by the defendant. If the court has no further questions, at this time I would respectfully request that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. You have 1 minute left, Mr. Curran.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, clear up a few things that were mentioned by the U.S. Attorney. Clearly, this is not a waiver. This is the paradigm of a forfeiture. It's exactly the type of forfeiture that was present in United States v. G. and United States v. Reynolds. It is nothing sort of affirmative conduct. I would refer the court to pages 1 and 2 of our reply brief, where we reproduce the entire context of the context of the so-called waiver in its entirety. It would direct this court to U.S. v. Griffin, the case that the government says proves waiver. It actually proves quite the opposite. It shows that a defendant who affirmatively selects a jury instruction, that's affirmative conduct. But a defendant who does not object, that's waiver. The two defendants in Griffin are very illustrative of the difference between waiver and forfeiture in this scenario. The government also notes that there was no evidence that would justify a buyer-seller instruction. That's plainly wrong. The government's only evidence was of a number of transactions. The government's only evidence was there were transactions here. There were buys and there were sales. Now, when the government produces that evidence to a jury, it's our position that the jury should be given a buyer-seller instruction because the jury may, and the facts of this case demonstrate, may believe only a handful, perhaps only one, of those transactions that the government is attempting to prove. If it does, it has no way to understand that a substantive sale is not a conspiracy without that instruction. And that defeats what this court has been doing over the last 10 years in its buyer-seller cases.
Yeah, I think we have the point, sir. Thank you very much. And Mr. Curran, you also served by appointment to this court, and you have the deep thanks of the court for a really fine job on behalf of your client today. And I think it would also be appropriate for us to express a corporate thanks to the University of Chicago Law School, who under Professor Mikva took care of half of our docket today. And I think I speak for all of the members of the panel in saying we all wish that 40 years ago we had a chance to work under you and learning how to do appellate arguments. thank you as well to the government. One of the educational benefits you've had today is fighting one of the best U.S. attorney's offices in the nation. So that's part of the educational experience, no doubt. So with that said, we thank both counsel and we'll take the case under advisement. And the court will rise until 9:30 tomorrow.